Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man number 38, Shootout of the Mountain Man. Narrated by Mort Shelby, with performances by James Lewis, Eric Messner, Richard Rowan, Patrick Bussink, Tim Carlin, Elizabeth Jernigan, Thomas Penny, David Coyne, Michael John Casey, Christopher Sheeran, Ken Jackson, Johan Detweiler, Daniel Sontag, Stephen Carpenter, Terrence Aselford, James Konacek, Joe Brack, Nick DePinto, Kimberly Gilbert, Casey Platt, Nanette Savard, Drew Copus, Michael Glenn, and Thomas Keegan.
Smoke Jensen was in Longmont Saloon playing cards with a few of his friends. Louis Longmont wasn't playing, but he was nearby, leaning up against the wall, adding his own comments to the conversation that flowed around the card table. Smoke was only partially participating in the conversation, and was only partially participating in the card game, as was demonstrated when he failed to respond to the dealer's request.
Smoke?
Garrett, a stagecoach driver, was one of the other players.
What?
How many cards?
I pass.
What do you mean you pass? You've already matched the bet.
Now play these.
Smoke? What's got into you? You seem to be somewhere else.
Now fold.
Laying his cards face down on the table, Smoke got up. He walked to the bar, moving to the opposite end from a young man who had come in a few minutes earlier. Smoke had noticed him the moment the young man came in. He was wearing his pistol low on his right side with the handle kicked out. He was sweating profusely, though it wasn't that hot. He had ordered one beer as soon as he came in, but he hadn't taken more than a sip the whole time he was there. Lewis came over to the bar.
Are you all right, Smoke? You're acting rather peculiar.
Better not stand too close to me, Lewis.
What?
Smoke nodded toward the young man at the opposite end of the bar. The young man was leaning over the bar, staring into his beer with his hands on either side of the glass. Lewis looked toward the man, then saw what Smoke had seen. It appeared that the nervous young man was trying to gather his nerve.
Draw me a beer, will you?
Lewis nodded, walked over to draw a mug of beer, then set it before Smoke. Without glancing at the young man at the far end of the bar, Lewis stepped away from Smoke, giving him all the room he might need.
Draw, Jensen!
Turning away from the bar, the young man made a grab for his pistol.
I already have.
The young man had his pistol only half withdrawn when he realized he was staring down the barrel of a gun, the pistol already in Smoke's hand.
What the? How did you do that? Don't shoot! Don't shoot!
Pull your gun out. Very slowly, using only your thumb and forefinger.
What are you gonna do, mister? Are you gonna kill me?
Why not? You were gonna kill me, weren't you?
Yeah, reckon I was.
Drop your pistol in there.
In the spittoon? No, I won't do that.
Oh, I think you will.
All right. All right.
Stepping over to the spittoon, he made a face and then dropped the pistol into it. Smoke holstered his pistol.
Lewis?
Yeah, Smoke?
Give the young man a new beer. On me.
Make it whiskey.
Lewis poured a shot and gave it to the would-be gunman. With a shaking hand, he lifted the glass to his lips, then tossed it down.
What's your name?
My name's Clark. Emmett Clark.
Why'd you want to kill me, Emmett Clark?
It's a matter of honor.
Honor? You think it's honorable to kill someone?
If you call them out and do it face to face... And if you're paying someone back for something they done to you...
Boy, I've never done anything to you. And I've never even heard of you.
Not to me, ain't. But you done it to my kin. Killed my pa. I was only 14 when you killed him. I taught myself how to shoot so I could get things all square.
What was your pa's name?
Clark, same as mine. Rob Clark. He was a banker in Aetna, and you shot and killed him when you was holding up the bank. You do remember that, don't you?
Yes, I remember that bank robbery. But I didn't have anything to do with it, or with shooting your father.
Don't tell me that, mister. You was found guilty of killing him. You was found guilty and sentenced to hang. I wanted to watch you hang, but my mom wouldn't have nothing to do with that. She went back to live with my grandparents in Kansas City, and I didn't have no choice but to go back with her. It's a long time before I found out that you didn't actually hang. You escaped.
Yes, I escaped. And I proved my innocence.
Proved your innocence? Expect me to believe that?
You should believe it, son, because it's true.
Stepping into the saloon a moment earlier, Monte Carson had stood just inside the door as a silent witness to the interplay between Smoke and Clark.
I got the wire that said Smoke had been completely cleared. He was set up by the folks who actually did rob the bank and kill your pa. I still got the wire down in my office if you need to be convinced.
I'm sorry about your father, boy. But as the sheriff said, I didn't have anything to do with it. It was someone else who killed him.
Where are they? Ones that killed my pa, I mean. Where are they now?
They're dead.
How do you know they're dead?
Because I killed them.
Damn. I reckon you'll be wanting to put me in jail now.
Why would I want to be putting you in jail?
I don't know. Attempted murder, I guess.
For what I could put together, there wasn't that much attempting to it, was there? I bet you didn't even get your pistol out of the holster.
No, sir, Sheriff, I reckon you got me there. Mr. Jensen sort of put a stop to it before it ever got started.
What do you think, Smoke? Should I put him in jail?
Clark, you said you were a man of honor. Is that true?
I ain't got no family now. My ma died last year. Never had no brothers. Ain't got hardly no money either. I reckon the only thing I got's worth anything is my honor, so yes, sir, I would say I am a man of honor.
Then I'm going to hold you to that honor, Clark. I'm going to let you ride out of here, trusting that you aren't going to be lying in wait somewhere, aiming to shoot me.
You got my word on that, Mr. Jensen. Satisfied that you didn't have anything to do with killing my pa. Makes sense to me anyway now that I think about it. If you were guilty, there'd be a paper out on you, and though I have looked, I haven't seen any.
Let him go, Sheriff.
Go on, boy. But I'd appreciate it if you would leave town.
Yes, sir. Really have no reason for staying now anyway.
Clark, have you ever used that gun?
Just to shoot at varmints and such. I've never used it against a man.
Do you plan to?
For the last few years, all I thought about was finding and killing you. And I didn't even figure that'd be wrong, seeing as how you'd been sentenced to hang but escaped. I don't have any plans to use it against a man, but I figure I could if it ever come to that.
Are you good with it?
Yes, sir. Damn good with it.
There will always be someone better. Remember that.
Yes, sir. Well, I reckon you just proved that to me, didn't you?
Smoke and the others in the saloon watched as the young man fished his gun out of the spittoon and walked out through the batwing doors.
He's gone.
I must say, Smoke, you seemed awfully easy on him.
I reckon I was. But then I look at him, and I see myself when I was on the blood trail after the ones who killed folks that were close to me.
You coming back to the game, Smoke?
No, I expect I better get on back out to the ranch. I've been in town long enough.
As Smoke Jensen was leaving Big Rock, back at his ranch, Sugarloaf, his wife Sally was sitting on a flat rock, high on an escarpment that guarded the north end of the ranch, protecting it from the icy blasts of winter. Sally had discovered this point of vigil, which she called Eagle Watch, shortly after she and Smoke were married and moved here into the high country to start their lives together. Reached by a circuitous and often hidden trail, Eagle Watch was covered with a mixture of pine and deciduous trees that offered green all year, while also providing a painter's palette of color in the spring when the crabapple and plum trees bloomed, and again in the fall when the aspen and maple leaves changed. In addition, the meadow itself was blanketed with wildflowers of every hue and description. Sally had come up here in her first week at the ranch to write a letter to her father back in Vermont, to try and give him an idea what she felt about her new home.
Smoke and I make our debut here in this wonderful place where the snowy mountains will look down upon us in the hottest summer day as well as the winter's cold. Here, where in the not-too-distant past, the wild beasts and the wilder Indians held undisturbed possession, where now surges the advancing wave of enterprise and civilization, and where soon, we proudly hope, will be erected a great and powerful state, another empire in the sisterhood of empires.
It was very much like Sally to express her thoughts in such a poetic fashion. She was a young woman of education and passion, sensitive to the rugged beauty of the home she shared with her husband, and filled with unbridled enthusiasm for the future. The letter had been written some years earlier, and since that time, Colorado had become a state. But though dated, the letter still remained appropriate to the way Sally felt about this place. From here, Sally could see the house Smoke had built for him. A large two-story edifice, white, with a porch that ran all the way across the front. It had turrets at each end of the front corners, the windows of which now shined gold in the reflected sunlight. Also in the compound were several other structures, including the bunkhouse, cook shack, barn, granary, and other outbuildings. She could also see many of the thousands of acres that made up Sugarloaf Ranch. Abandoning her contemplation of the ranch, she turned her attention to the road that ran from Sugarloaf into Big Rock. There, she saw a plume of dust. Then, just ahead of the plume, a galloping Appaloosa. She smiled at the sight. Smoke was coming home at a gallop. Mounting her own horse, Sally started back down the trail toward the ranch compound. Her horse was sure-footed and nimble enough to traverse the distance rather quickly, thus allowing her to reach the house before Smoke did. Dismounting, she climbed up onto the wide porch so she could watch his arrival. The road, which on the state and county maps was called Jensen Pike, ran parallel with a long fence before it turned in through a gate that had the name of the ranch fashioned from wrought iron letters in the arch above. But as Sally knew he would, Smoke didn't come through the gate. Instead, he left the road, then urging Seven into a mighty jump, sailing over the fence almost as if on wings. After successfully negotiating the fence, he galloped into the compound before pulling the horse to a stop and leaping down from the saddle.
Seven, you are the greatest horse in the world.
You've said that to the other three horses you named Seven, and the two you named Drifter.
Oh, they were the greatest horses in the world, too.
Don't be silly. There can only be one greatest.
No, that's the schoolteacher in you talking. If you love horses, you know there can be as many greatest horses as you want.
All right. I guess I can't argue with you on that. How was your trip to town? Did anything interesting happen?
Not really.
Not really? That means something, actually.
Tell me, woman, when I think something, do words just appear on my forehead for you to read my thoughts?
Yes. Now tell me what happened.
Smoke told Sally of his confrontation with Emmett Clark, finishing with the fact that he let him ride away.
Oh, Smoke, do you think that was smart?
I don't know if it was smart. You're the smart one of the family, but I think it was right. I believe him when he said that he's a man of honor, and I respect honor.
That's because you're a man of honor. Take care of Seven and wash up. I'll have dinner ready soon.
Esmeralda County, Nevada. Bobby Lee Cabot could see the four men who were with him, their ponchos pulled about them, scrunched down in their saddles. It was raining hard, and Bobby Lee readjusted his own poncho as he waded with the others alongside a railroad water tank. Under the frequent flashes of lightning, the steel tracks of the Nevada Central Railroad glistened in the rain.
What if a train don't come?
A train comes every night, Conklin. What makes you think it won't come tonight?
Frank Dodd was the leader of the group. Dodd was just under 6 feet tall, with broad shoulders and powerful arms. In his middle 40s, he had spent more than half his life in prison. In a prison fight, another inmate had cut off half of his left eyelid, as well as a piece of his upper lip, leaving him permanently scarred. That same encounter had left the man who scarred him permanently dead.
What if this here train don't have no money on it?
What if I just put my boot up your ass for asking so damn many dumb questions?
I'm just asking, Zol.
Well, don't ask.
The five men were waiting alongside the track, halfway between Lone City and Cloverdale, Nevada. They were here in the middle of the night, in the middle of a rainstorm, because it was their plan to rob the train when it stopped for water. Actually, it was only the plan of the other four. Unbeknownst to the others, Bobby Lee was a railroad detective with the Western Capital Security Agency. He had worked his way into the gang in order to find a way to bring them to justice. Shortly before departing on this train robbery expedition, Bobby Lee had sent a letter to Herman Wallace, the sheriff of Esmeralda County, notifying him of the gang's intentions. In the letter, he asked Sheriff Wallace to be riding in the express car with enough deputies to end the train robbing spree of Frank Dodd, Walter Conklin, Waylon Morris, and Jules Stillwater. That would go well for Bobby Lee, who'd spent 6 months tracking him, then getting himself into position to stop the bandits. He was sure the railroad company would give him a bonus for his part, but it wasn't the bonus that motivated him. It was the satisfaction of taking out a gang of robbers who had been a thorn in the side of the railroad for the better part of 2 years. The rain stopped and some of the clouds rolled away, revealing a full moon which illuminated the area almost as bright as day.
This ain't good. Moon bright like this. Don't be able to identify us.
You think they're gonna know who we are? All right, boys, get ready. It'll be here soon.
They waited a moment longer until they could hear the puffing of the steam engine as the train worked its way up the long grade approaching the water tank. Now the great headlamp was in view. But as the moon was bright, the lamp was projecting no visible beam of light. When the train rounded a corner, it exposed its entire length so the men could see all five cars behind it, every window of each passenger car showing light. As the train grew closer to the water tower, it began braking.
Wait till it comes to a complete stop.
The train stopped. The fireman left the engine, then climbed up onto the tender and reached up for the water spout.
All right, they ain't paying no attention to us now. Let's ease on down there.
As the others approached the train, Bobby Lee dropped back behind to be in position. Any moment now, the car doors would open. Sheriff Wallace and his deputies would be waiting. They would confront the robbers, and if Dodd tried to make a run for it, Bobby Lee would be in position to stop him.
Conklin, you and Waylon get up to the engine cab. Make sure that engineer don't suddenly decide to take off.
He ain't gonna go nowhere with the fireman up on the tender like that.
Just do what I told you to do. Stillwater, you and Cabot come with me.
The two men rode down to the engine cab.
You! Put your hands up!
While that was going on, Dodd and Stillwater approached the express car. With Bobby Lee remaining slightly behind the other two, Dodd banged on the door with the butt of his pistol.
You boys in there got two choices. You can either open up the door and not get hurt, or keep the door closed and more than likely get killed when I blow up the car with dynamite.
Oh, they're gonna open the door, all right.
When the door to the express car opened, there was nobody there but one frightened express agent. Where the hell was Sheriff Wallace? It took very little persuasion for the express agent to pass down two large cloth bags. Dodd opened them and looked down inside.
Yahoo!
Boys! These is all $20 bills. It gotta be a couple of $1,000 or more. Come on, let's get out of here.
Conklin and Waylon came back from the engine and the robbers made ready to ride away. Before they left though, Dodd turned back toward the train and shot the express agent.
Ah! Why'd you do that? You didn't have any call to shoot him.
He's seen our faces. Come on, let's go!
Bobby Lee started to ride away with the other four, but he stopped, then turned and rode back to the train. Dismounting, he hurried over to the still form of the express man. He put his hand on the man's neck to feel for a pulse, but there wasn't any. The man was dead. By now, some of the passengers had stepped down from the train, and three of the men, holding pistols in their hands, approached Bobby Lee.
Mister, shooting him was dumb enough. But coming back here to gloat over what you done is about the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
Is the sheriff on board this train?
Don't need no sheriff. I reckon we can handle you till we get you to town.
No, you don't understand. My name is Bobby Lee Cabot. I'm with the Western Capital Security Agency. I told Sheriff Wallace about this robbery. This was supposed to be a setup to capture the robbers.
Well, if you and the sheriff said good friends, then I reckon you two can get it all worked out when we get to town. Get his gun, Joe.
The passenger named Joe pulled Bobby Lee's pistol from his holster.
Look here, I told you I wasn't with them.
Mister, do you take us for fools? We saw you with them.
Yes, I was with them, but I was setting a trap for them. I thought the sheriff would be on this train and he could arrest them.
A likely start.
Bobby Lee offered no resistance when the armed train passengers bound and gagged him like a trussed-up calf, then threw him bodily and painfully onto the floor of the express car. With two short blasts on the engine's whistle, followed by a series of jolts and jerks, the train got underway again.
You picked the wrong train to rob. Yes, sir. There were some of us on board won't put up with nothing like that.
Bobby Lee wanted to explain to him about his plan to set up a trap for Frank Dodd, to prove to him that he was indeed an employee of the Western Capital Security Agency. But the gag prevented him from talking. There was nothing he could do now but lean back against the side of the car and make himself as comfortable as possible for the remainder of the ride. Bobby Lee Cabot was 24 years old. He was a slender man with more strength than his appearance suggested. His hair was sun-bleached and his eyes were a cross between gunmetal gray and sky blue. Women found him rather appealing, and men, well, they weren't intimidated by him. That sort of low-key combination worked well for him in his profession as a private detective, because it enabled him to blend easily with his surroundings. The first part of it had worked well. He had been accepted into Frank Dodd's gang. Perhaps it had worked too well, because he had not only convinced Dodd and his men that he was one of them, but now the train passengers were equally as convinced. It was late at night, and there'd be another 2 hours before they reached Cloverdale. As a result, Bobby Lee's guard fell asleep. Bobby Lee worked himself out of the ropes and removed the gag. Then, quietly and carefully, he took the gun from the sleeping guard's hand. Having freed himself, he returned to his position against the side of the car. It was just after dawn as the train began braking for its approach into Cloverdale.
What the hell?
He saw that Bobby Lee was sitting against the side of the car, holding the pistol. The would-be guard threw his arms up.
No, mister, don't shoot! I got a wife and kids, don't shoot!
Relax, I'm not gonna shoot you. I told you, I'm not one of the outlaws. I wanna see the sheriff. I plan to get this all straightened out.
He handed the pistol back to the guard.
I believe this belongs to you.
Cloverdale was awakening on the new day when the train arrived. The stagecoach was waiting for any passengers who might need a connection to the nearby towns that weren't served by the railroad. Freight wagons were already beginning their morning runs, stores were opening, and citizens were moving about. Word that the train had been robbed was quickly spread through the town, so that soon a rather substantial crowd had gathered around the depot to watch, sadly, as the messenger's body was taken down. Sheriff Wallace arrived then, pushing his way importantly through the crowd.
Open up here. Let me through. Make way.
Anyone looking down from an elevated position would have seen the crowd parting, then closing in behind him as he made his way to the platform alongside the express car, where two armed passengers were holding Bobby Lee prisoner.
Here he is, Sheriff. We caught this fellow red-handed right after the train was robbed and the messenger was killed.
I want to thank you, men, for bringing him in. This will save me the trouble and the county the expense of having to go after him.
Sheriff Wallace was a very big man, 6 feet 6 inches tall. He had a round, bald head that sat on his shoulders with very little visible neck. His ears were so small that they seemed mismatched for his head. He wasn't just tall, either. He was big, weighing right at 300 pounds.
Whoa, what do you mean, save you the trouble of going after me? What's this about, Sheriff?
This is about bringing you to trial, finding you guilty and hanging you. That's what it's about.
Sheriff, maybe I ought to tell you something.
What?
Well, sir, I fell asleep while we was coming in this morning. When I come to, this here fellow's free and hold my gun.
He should have been more careful.
Yes, but my point is, he could have got away, only he didn't. He gave me my gun back to me. Sort of makes you think, don't it?
Think about what?
Well, it makes you think about whether or not he's guilty. I mean, if he was guilty, wouldn't he maybe killed me, then got away?
Maybe. Or maybe he just figured it would make him look innocent.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that wasn't it.
Come along, Cabot. I got a jail cell waiting for you.
Bobby Lee was about to say something else, but he held his tongue when he decided that perhaps the sheriff was merely trying to protect his undercover status. He remained quiet until the sheriff took him down to his office.
I have to confess that you had me worried there for a moment, but I understand now what you're doing.
Do you?
Yeah. You're protecting my identity. You're going to wait until they leave town before you let me out.
What do you mean I'm protecting your identity? You are Bobby Lee Cabot, and as soon as we start the trial, the whole world is going to know who you are. What makes you think I'm going to let you out?
I expect you to let me out because of the arrangement we had.
What arrangement? What are you talking about?
Sheriff Wallace, you are beginning to make me uncomfortable. You know damn well what arrangement we had. We not only talked about it in some detail, I also sent you a letter telling you about the robbery. I asked you to be in the car with deputies. If you had done what I asked, we could have stopped this. That messenger would still be alive, and you would have Frank Dodd and his entire gang in jail.
We never had any such conversation, and I did not receive a letter from you.
Of course you received it. You have to have received it. I sent it to you in plenty of time.
I don't know what kind of trick you're trying to pull, Cabot, but you aren't going to get away with it.
In the parlor of the house Smoke had built for his wife at Sugarloaf, on the wall opposite the windows, there was a picture that Smoke particularly liked. Sally found it rather jarring, but tolerated it because of her love for Smoke. The picture, cut from a calendar, was a full-color Courier and Ives print of two night trains racing out of Washington, D.C., sparks flying from the stats, and with every window and every car shining brightly. It was a dramatic, if unrealistic, representation. Just below the calendar was the stove, cool now as there was no need for it, but with the faint aroma of smoke from last year's use still clinging to the black iron. Sally was doing some crochet while Smoke was looking at a new stack of stereo opticon photographs. At the moment, he was looking at a picture of London's Big Ben. They were equally involved in their pursuits when Pearlie knocked on the front door.
Come in, Pearlie.
Something I can do for you, Pearlie?
Yes, sir, I reckon there is. If you're of mind to allow it, that is.
Allow it? What is it I am to allow?
Well, me and Cal have been thinking.
Now that's something that I would like to have seen. Imagine, you and Cal, both thinking at the same time.
Oh, Smoke, don't tease so.
All right, I'm sorry. But it did seem like a funny thought to me.
Yes, sir, well, I admit that thinking ain't something me and Cal do all that well. But thinking is what we was doing all right, and what we'd like to do is ride off to Denver and see if me and him could ride in that there rodeo they're holding. We could win us some money.
Are you saying I don't pay you two enough?
Oh, no, no, we don't mean nothing like that. It's just that, well, sir, me and Cal is both pretty good riders, and we just love to prove it's all.
Smoke, stop teasing them. You knew they were planning this. I told you all about it.
I know. I was just having a little fun is all. I'm sorry, Pearly. Of course you and Cal can go. When are you leaving?
The rodeo's in a couple weeks from now. We're leaving about Monday of the week of the rodeo. That's if and you don't mind.
What do you think, Sally?
I have no problem with them going, but his grammar, it's positively atrocious.
Now who's teasing him?
I am not teasing. I am teaching.
You plan on being a teacher forever, do you? You gave up that job a long time ago.
Teaching isn't a job. It's a never-ending commitment. Yes, I will continue to teach for as long as I live.
And I will continue to learn as long as you are willing to teach.
Me too.
Pearly, you are a challenge.
Three days after Bobby Lee was brought into Cloverdale under guard, his trial got underway when Judge Briggs came through the town as part of his circuit. Briggs arrived in a carriage that was driven by a black man who was also his bodyguard. His Honor, Judge Jeremiah J. Briggs, was a tall, thin, some might even describe him as cadaverous man. He had a sallow complexion, sunken cheeks, deep-set eyes that were so brown that there was little delineation between iris and pupil, dark, bushy eyebrows, and dark hair. He wore a black suit with a burgundy vest and matching cravat. Because there were only two lawyers in town, Briggs appointed one as the prosecutor and the other as defense counsel. Arriving at 10 in the morning, Judge Briggs gave the lawyers, both for the prosecution and the defense, until 2 o'clock that afternoon to prepare their case.
I expect to have this case tried and adjudicated before supper. You think we can do that?
Ray Roswell, who had been appointed as the prosecutor, nodded confidently.
Your Honor, I have an entire trainload of passengers who are witnesses to the murder. I expect this to be a quick and easy trial.
Mr. Reed, will you have time to prepare your case by 2 o'clock?
Judge Briggs spoke to the defense counsel.
Easily, Your Honor. There is little to prepare for. Unfortunately for me, it seems to be an open and shut case against my client.
Very well. Court will convene at 2 o'clock sharp.
Reed went directly from the meeting in the judge's hotel room to the jail, where he asked to speak with the prisoner.
He's back there.
Bobby Lee was lying on the bunk with his hands laced behind his head when the door from the sheriff's office opened, and a fat man with a florid face and thin blonde hair stepped into the back. He was sweating profusely, and he held a sweat-soaked handkerchief in his hand.
Bobby Lee Campbell?
Cabot.
I beg your pardon?
Bobby Lee Cabot, that's my name.
The fat man pulled a piece of paper from his pocket and looked at it, his lips moving as he read the print.
Yes, Cabot. That's you?
It is.
My name's Jack Reed. I've been appointed as your defense attorney.
Bobby Lee extended his hand, but saw that Jack Reed made no effort to reciprocate, so he pulled his hand back.
Why am I being appointed an attorney? I can afford my own attorney.
There are only two counselors in Cloverdale. The judge has appointed Mr. Roswell as prosecutor, so that leaves me for you.
I guess that answers my question, don't it?
I'm here to help prepare your defense. We go to trial at 2 o'clock this afternoon.
That's only an hour and 45 minutes. That doesn't leave us much time, does it?
It's time enough for the defense I have planned.
And what defense is that?
I've looked at the case for the prosecution, Mr. Cabot, and my advice to you is to plead guilty and throw yourself upon the mercy of the court.
What? I'll do no such thing. I was not a participant in the robbery. I was trying to stop it.
Mr. Cabot, the entire train saw you riding with Dodd and the others.
Yes, yes, of course I was riding with them. It was all part of the plan. I was to ride with them and gather information as to when and where their next robbery would take place.
But the entire train saw you with them. It'll be their word against yours.
I don't deny that I was riding with Dodd. The passengers did see that, but what the passengers could not see was my intent. Why was I riding with Dodd?
Is that really the case you want to make?
Of course it is the case I want to make. It's the truth, so I can do little else.
All right, I'll do what I can, but don't expect much. I'll see you in court at 2:00.
Oh, wait. That's it? You're leaving now? That's all the preparation you're going
to
do.
What else is there to prepare? You tell me that you're with Dodd because somehow you had planned to trap him and the others, right?
Yeah.
And I'm prepared.
At 2:00 that afternoon, Deputy Beard led a handcuffed Bobby Lee into the courtroom, which was actually the bar room of the Depot Hotel. Sheriff Wallace came in.
Hear ye, hear ye. This here trial is about to commence. The Honorable Jeremiah J. Briggs presiding. Everybody stand respectful.
The Honorable Jeremiah J. Briggs came out of a back room. After taking his seat at the bench, he put on his glasses, fitting the earpieces very carefully over each ear, one at a time.
You may be seated.
Judge Briggs picked up a piece of paper and looked at it for a moment before speaking.
There comes now before this court defendant Bobby Lee Cabot, charged with murder pursuant to the shooting death of August Fletcher on the night of August 21st in the current year. Is the defendant represented by counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. I am counsel for the defense.
Is the state represented by counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. We may proceed. Would the bailiff please bring the accused before the bench?
Sheriff Wallace, who was acting as bailiff for this trial, walked over to the table where Bobby Lee sat next to Jack Reed.
Get up, Cabot. Present yourself before the judge.
Bobby Lee Cabot, you stand accused of the crime of murder, specifically the murder of August Fletcher, Mr. Fletcher being at the time of his demise a messenger for the Nevada Central Railway Company. How do you plead?
Not guilty, Your Honor.
Prosecutor, make your case.
Gentlemen of the jury, you have been assembled here today to adjudicate the case of murder. It is a difficult duty, but a duty of great honor, for in it lies the entire underpinnings of our republic. You are exercising the rights and privileges secured for us by thousands of brave young men who died upon fields of battle. Men who gave their last full measure of devotion so that, for as long as our republic shall endure, men like you can perform the noble duty of providing a fair trial for those such as the accused. Defense may claim that his was not the finger that pulled the trigger, but by law, that does not matter. He was in the act of committing a felony, and during commission of that felony, an innocent man was killed. That makes everyone concerned equally guilty. I am confident, in fact, I fully expect, that at the conclusion of this trial, you will exercise the most solemn duty of your purview, and that is to find guilty and recommend the penalty of death by hanging for the defendant, Bobby Lee Cabot.
Reed put his sweat-dampened handkerchief on the table, then walked over to the jury. By contrast to Roswell's smooth and dignified appearance, Reed's suit hung in such a misshapen fashion that he looked for all the world like a stuffed sausage.
That Mr. Cabot was there, we cannot deny. It was a full moon that night, and though it had rained earlier, the clouds moved away, which meant that my client was seen by nearly everyone on the train, bending over the body of poor Mr. Fletcher. In fact, three passengers from the train disarmed Mr. Cabot and brought him here to jail. But Bobby Lee Cabot is not the man who did the actual shooting, and I ask you to bear that in mind.
As Roswell had just pointed out to the jury that it didn't matter whether Bobby Lee had been the shooter or not, everyone in the court looked at each other and shook their heads in total contempt for Reed's efforts. Reed sat back down.
You are fired.
You can't fire me. I'm the only lawyer in town.
I'll defend myself.
You know what they say. The man who defends himself has a fool for a lawyer.
I couldn't have a worse fool for a lawyer if I chose the town drunk. Your Honor, I am firing my counselor.
Your Honor, I object.
You object to what, counselor?
I object to this man firing me.
Objection overruled. He has every right to fire you and every right to defend himself.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Don't thank me, young man. I fear you have chosen an impossible task for yourself. You may present your case.
Your Honor, I was not a member of Frank Dodd's gang. I am an employee of the Western Capital Security Agency, and I had infiltrated his gang not for any personal gain, but for the sole purpose of setting a trap for him. That's why I sent a letter to Sheriff Wallace, explaining what I was doing, providing him with information as to the date and time of the holdup, and the place, which was the watering tower 10 miles south of Lone City. In that same letter, I asked him to be in the car with the deputies in order to facilitate the arrest of Dodd and his confederates.
Objection, Your Honor. The letter is not in evidence.
Can you produce the letter, Mr. Cabot?
No, sir. I sent the letter to Sheriff Wallace, so I don't have it. But I can prove that I sent it.
How can you prove it?
I would like to call as my first witness Minnie Smith. I told her about the letter.
Objection, Your Honor. That would be hearsay.
Sustained. You cannot call Miss Smith.
Then I would like to call Dr. Baker to the stand.
Did Dr. Baker actually see you mail the letter?
No, sir. He didn't see me mail the letter, but I told him that I was going to mail the letter, and I told him before I sent it.
Objection.
Sustained.
May I call Nate Neighbors?
Are you calling Mr. Neighbors as a character or a material witness?
I'm not sure I understand the difference.
A character witness will testify as to your character. He will tell what a fine, upstanding citizen you are when you are not murdering Western Capital Security Agency messengers. A material witness's testimony will provide direct evidence pertaining to the case.
In that case, Your Honor, Mr. Neighbors is a material witness.
You may call him.
Nate!
Your Honor, may I inquire if the defendant is going to ask the witness about the supposed letter?
Are you going to ask about the letter?
Your Honor, I told Mr. Neighbors about the letter.
Did you show him the letter? Did he see you mail it?
No, Your Honor.
Objection sustained. You may not call the witness, Mr. Cabot.
Your Honor, if you won't let me call any witnesses, then I don't know how I'm going to prove that I sent that letter.
If the only witnesses you have are people that you told about the letter, then their testimony would be considered hearsay and is not admissible. Have you anything else to offer in your defense?
Wait a minute. What about Fred Welch?
Who's Fred Welch?
I'm Fred Welch, Your Honor.
He was sitting in the gallery.
Mr. Cabot, what is Mr. Welch's relationship to this case?
He is the postman, Your Honor. He delivered the letter.
Is that right, Mr. Welch? Did you deliver the letter in question?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Your Honor, I deliver hundreds of pieces of mail every day. And I deliver a lot of mail to the sheriff. I don't ever notice who the mail is from, only where it's going. It could be that I delivered the letter that Mr. Cabot is talking about, but if I did, I don't remember it.
Your Honor, if this witness cannot support the defendant's claim as to the delivery of the letter, then I see no merit to his being called.
I agree, Mr. Roswell. Defense, move to call Fred Welch as a witness is denied.
Your Honor, you have not let me call any witnesses at all.
That's because you've not presented a witness who is material to the case. Now, I will ask you again. Have you anything further to present in your defense?
Only that I didn't do it. I mean, yes, sir, I was there. But like I say, I was there trying to catch the Frank Dodd gang. And if Sheriff Wallace had done what I asked him to do in the letter, if he had been there like he was supposed to, then more than likely, Mr. Fletcher would still be alive, and Dodd and the others with him would be in jail.
Objection, Your Honor. As the letter is not in evidence, it cannot again be mentioned, either in presentation or summary.
Sustained. Do you understand what that means, Mr. Cabot?
I'm not sure that I do understand, Judge.
It means that this letter, whether real or supposed, is of no use to you in your defense. You may not mention it again. Do you understand it now?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have anything else to present in your defense?
No, Your Honor.
Very well. Mr. Roswell, make your case.
Your Honor, prosecution calls Sheriff Herman Wallace to the stand.
Sheriff Wallace, take the stand, please.
Wallace stood, hiked up his trousers, then walked to the front of the courtroom. After he was sworn in, he took the stand, which was a chair next to the table Judge Briggs was using as his bench. Wallace was so big that once he sat down, none of the chair could be seen. As a result, it almost looked as if he were just squatting in front of the room. And for some reason, despite the severity of the moment, Bobby Lee found the picture pretty funny.
Do you find these proceedings funny, Mr. Cabot?
No, Your Honor.
Then please display the proper decorum in my courtroom.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counselor, you may continue with your direct.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sheriff Wallace, defense claims that the two of you were working together. He further claims that he provided you with all the information as to time and place regarding the robbery, and that you were to secret yourself in the express car for the purpose of arresting Dodd when the robbery was attempted. Are any of those claims true?
No, they are not.
Let's dismiss this subject of a letter once and for all. Did you receive a letter from the defendant outlining all or any of these proposals?
I did not.
Would you have acted if you had received such a letter?
Absolutely. For the opportunity to take out the Dodd gang, I would have done anything necessary. But I never received such a letter.
Do you know Minnie Smith, the person that Cabot attempted to call on his behalf?
I know who she is, yes.
Assuming the judge had allowed her to testify, would her testimony have been credible?
I doubt it.
Why not?
Miss Smith is, I don't like to say it, in mixed company.
Come now, Sheriff. We're all adults, and we bear a serious responsibility with this trial. So I ask you again, why do you feel that Miss Smith's testimony would not be credible?
She is a soiled dove.
I beg your pardon?
She is a whore.
Roswell nodded, then looked toward the young woman who was sitting in the front row.
Is her profession the only reason you would find her testimony untrustworthy?
No, sir. Like all whores, I suppose, she has her favorite. And for reasons unbeknownst to me, Bobby Lee Cabot seems to be that one. Though what she sees in him, I'll never know.
I object!
What is your objection, Mr. Cabot?
I object to them calling Miss Smith a whore!
I'm going to accept your objection, Mr. Cabot, but not for the reason you stated. It had already been ruled that Miss Smith cannot testify. Therefore, any reference to her in any way will not be allowed. Please disregard everything you've heard about Miss Smith's reliability as a witness, as she will not be a witness. And, Counselor, if you introduce her again during the course of these proceedings, I will hold you in contempt. Do you understand me, sir?
I do, Your Honor.
You may continue with your direct.
Thank you, Sheriff. No further questions. Your witness.
Bobby Lee made no reply.
Mr. Cabot, do you wish to cross-examine this witness?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
Do you wish to ask this witness any questions?
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
Then now is the time to do so.
Bobby Lee walked over to stand near the sheriff.
Sheriff, when those people from the train brought me in to you as their prisoner, did one of the men who had been guarding me tell you that during the night he'd fallen asleep and that I had loosened my bonds and took possession of his pistol?
Yes.
And did that same man tell you that when he was awoke the next morning, I returned the pistol?
Yes.
Do you not think that if I were truly guilty, I would have escaped during the night?
The train was running.
Has no one ever jumped from a running train before?
I suppose they have.
Don't you think that the reason I did not try to escape was because I knew I was innocent and I believed you would back me up?
No. I just think you wanted to try and fool the guard into believing you were innocent.
Now, what would be the advantage of that? He had no authority to clear my name. Only you have that authority.
I don't know what you mean.
Yes, you do, Sheriff. You knew what we had planned. Don't you think I had every reason to believe that you would let me go?
I don't know. Maybe you were crazy.
Sheriff, did I not tell you when we returned to the jail that I was surprised that you weren't in the express car? Did my letter not ask you to do that?
Look here, I never got this letter you're talking about.
Objection, Your Honor. This supposed letter has already been dealt with.
Your Honor, you said the others couldn't testify because I only had told them about the letter. The sheriff is the person I sent the letter to. If I did send it and he denies it, then he is lying under oath. And isn't that called perjury?
It is indeed called perjury, Mr. Cabot. Prosecution's objection is overruled. You may continue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sheriff Wallace, knowing that you are under oath, I ask you again. Did you receive the letter I sent?
No.
Without regard to the letter, in conversation did I or did I not tell you that I had joined Dodd's gang for the purpose of setting a trap for him and that I wanted you and your deputies to be in the express car?
I don't recall any such conversation.
You are denying that we spoke about this, and you are denying that you received a letter from me.
Objection, Your Honor. Questions have been asked and answered.
Sustained. Counselor, I believe you've taken this line of questioning about as far as you can take it. Do you have any questions of a different line?
No, sir. Your Honor.
Redirect, Mr. Prosecutor?
No, Your Honor.
Do you have any further witnesses, Mr. Roswell?
I have no further witnesses, Your Honor. But I do have a letter from the WCSA that I would like to read into the court records as evidence.
And the WCSA is?
The Western Capital Security Agency, Your Honor. It is the private detective group for which Bobby Lee Cabot claims he was working undercover.
You may read the letter.
The Western Capital Security Agency has no record of recommending that Mr. Cabot associate himself with the outlaw Frank Dodd. On the contrary, we would strongly oppose such an idea. If Mr. Cabot was functioning as a part of the Dodd gang, it was for reasons of his own and not for any type of investigative operation.
Quiet! Quiet in the court!
Your Honor, that doesn't prove anything. I didn't tell the agency that I was doing this.
Are you putting that in the form of an objection, Mr. Cabot?
An objection, yeah. Yes, sir, Your Honor.
Objection overruled. You may continue, Counselor.
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to point out to the jury that because of Cabot's connection with the Western Capital Security Agency, he would know all the schedules, and he would know which trains would be carrying large amounts of money. This would make him a valuable asset to someone like Frank Dodd. And with that, prosecution rests.
Thank you. Summation, Mr. Cabot?
I beg your pardon?
This is where you make your final appeal to the jury.
I can't prove that I'm innocent, because neither Miss Smith nor Doc Baker nor Nate Neighbors could stand up here and tell you what I told them about the letter. And Sheriff Wallace, who was the only witness I spoke to, lied. Also, I know that the letter from the WCSA makes it look bad for me, but everything I said is true. I worked my way into the Dodd gang so I could set it up for the sheriff to capture them in the act. Only the sheriff wasn't theirs, so nothing went the way it was supposed to. So here I am, on trial for my life. And there doesn't seem to be anything I can do about it except tell you that I am not guilty.
Mr. Roswell, your summation?
Gentlemen of the jury, I believe my case has been made. All you have to do is consider the facts in evidence. I am confident you will come up with the verdict of guilty of murder in the first degree.
After the judge charged the jury, the 12 men retired to one of the other rooms of the hotel to consider. It took but 10 minutes for him to return a verdict of guilty.
Will the defendant stand before the bench, please? Mr. Reed, approach with him.
He fired me, Your Honor.
Nevertheless, you are the court-appointed attorney of record. I don't want any technicalities coming up after the fact. Please approach with him.
Yes, Your Honor.
Bobby Lee Cabot, you have been found guilty as charged. It is therefore the order of this court that a gallows be built sufficient to provide the mechanism needed to extinguish your life by hanging. Said event to take place on the 31st of this month. May God have mercy on your soul. Sheriff, remove the prisoner.
The aroma of freshly made bear claws drifted out of the kitchen and into the yard, all the way over to the bunkhouse.
What are you doing?
Without answering, Pearly pulled on his boots and started for the door. Before he reached that door, Cal got a whiff as well, and even though he only had on one boot, he ran after Pearly. The two men burst into the kitchen just as Sally was taking the pastries from the oven.
My, oh my, do them smell good.
It's do those smell good.
Oh, very good, Cal. I'm impressed.
Seems to me like somebody that can't speak English good probably ought not to get any bear claws.
Oh, I'm afraid that would leave you out as well.
Oh,
Why?
It can't speak English well.
Oh, well, I was just teasing. Sure, I want Pearly to have some.
That's very generous of you, sharing my bear claw like that.
Your bear claws? That's funny. I thought I was the one that made them.
Well, you didn't make them all for yourself, did you, Miss Sally?
No, I didn't make them all for myself. You can have one as soon as they're cool enough for you to... never mind.
Al and Pearly each grabbed one and stuffed it in their mouths.
Must be a special occasion for you to make bear claws this morning. Anything I might know about?
Maybe.
Smoke knew she was referring to their intimacy during the night, and he smiled back. Then he reached for a bear claw, too.
Always glad I could please.
What? Why, you?
What are y'all talking about?
Cal, are you going to put that boot on, or just stand here in my kitchen with it dangling from your hand?
I'm going to put it on.
And with the bear claw hanging from his mouth, he sat on the floor and pulled the other boot on.
So what are you two boys going to do today?
Ride fence up in the north quarter.
You'll be out all day. Better have the cook put you up a lunch.
Yes, sir. I thought we would.
And maybe...
You can each take a couple more with you.
Thank you.
The two young cowboys grabbed the bear claw-shaped donuts, then hurried out the kitchen to begin their daily chores.
I wish someone would invent a machine and let you look inside a person. I swear the only innards either of them have is a stomach.
You aren't far behind.
It's your fault. You're just too damn good a cook.
Back in the jail cell in Cloverdale, Nevada, Bobby Lee Cabot was lying on his bunk, his hands laced behind his head as he stared up at the ceiling.
Are you scared, Bobby Lee?
The question came from the prisoner who was in the cell next to his. Andy Emerson was a small man, around 5 feet 5 inches tall, with a sweeping mustache that seemed oversized for his short stature. He was also a cowboy who drank too much. Now, he was never a mean drunk, though he did, in his own words, sometimes develop a mountain lion's attitude in a pussycat's body. He often manifested this mannerism when confronting Sheriff Wallace or one of his deputies, and as a result, Wallace had a personal grudge against him. Andy spent a lot of time in jail for public drunkenness, when others, who were often drunker, were given a pass.
I guess I'm a little frightened.
A little frightened? If I was about to be hanged, I'd be so scared I couldn't even talk. You're about the bravest person I ever met.
I'm not that brave, Andy, believe me. What's the sheriff got you in for now?
Oh, I was at the Gold Strike last night. I had a few drinks, sure, but I wasn't drunk. You can ask anybody there. Well, the next thing you know, Wallace was in there accusing me of getting drunk and causing a disturbance, and... The thing is, well, he kept pushing till I got mad and I shoved him. And then I really was causing a disturbance. But only because he sort of drove me to it.
Andy, we've talked about this before. You really do have to cut back on your drinking. You've gotten yourself on the sheriff's bad side, and he's just going to keep riding you till you really do get in trouble.
I know. You've always been straight with me. I ought to pay attention to you.
At that moment, Deputy Harley Beard came into the back and opened the door to Andy's cell.
Hey, you can go now, but next time we catch you drunk in town, you'll wind up in here again.
Yeah. Bobby Lee, when it happens, when they hang you, I ain't gonna be there watching. I hope you understand. I always figured you for a friend, and I don't think I want to watch a friend get his neck stretched. And that don't mean I ain't going to be thinking about you. It's just that I don't want to be here when it's happening.
Yeah, I understand.
Bye, Bobby Lee.
You going to hang around jabbering with him, or are you going to get out of here? Because if you're going to hang around, I can put you back in jail and you two folks can just visit all you want.
I'm going.
Beard waited until Andy left before he turned to Bobby Lee's cell.
Cabot, you got a visitor.
Who is it?
Who is it? It's the whore. Who else would waste their time coming to see you?
Oh, good. Please send her in.
Beard disappeared into the front of the building, and a moment later, Minnie Smith came in. Minnie was a pretty girl, and she would have been prettier, Bobby Lee believed, if she would just let nature take its course. But, defying nature, she had dyed her hair, which was naturally auburn, a henna-tinted red. Her eyes were shaded, her cheeks were rouged, and her lips were painted. The dye and makeup was because of Minnie's occupation, which technically was saloon hostess, though other sobriquets were used, such as hurdy-gurdy girl, parlor girl, and soiled dove. In truth, she was a prostitute. But Bobby Lee saw more than that in her. Minnie had been present all during his trial and had cried bitter tears when Bobby Lee was sentenced.
Oh, Bobby Lee, I can't stand it. I know you sent that letter to Sheriff Wallace. You told me about it. But I can't get anyone to believe me. I'm so sorry. Do you know they're building a gallows right now in front of this very building?
Yes. Minnie, I need you to do something for me.
What? What do you want? I'll do anything you ask.
I want you to send a telegram for me.
A telegram? To the governor? It won't do any good, Bobby Lee. I've already sent a telegram to the governor.
No, not to the governor. I want you to send this to a friend of mine. If there's anybody in the world who can do anything for me, it'll be him.
All right. Give me the name of the person. Tell me what you want to say and where you want it to go. I'll send it.
After Minnie received her instructions and left, Bobby Lee lay back down on his bunk again to resume staring at the ceiling above. Realistically, Bobby Lee knew the chances were only about 1 in 100 that the telegram would reach its destination. According to the sentence of the judge, he was to hang on the 31st. That was only 1 week away. Bobby Lee was sure that Minnie would send the telegram. He had that much faith in her. But he really had no sense of confidence that the telegram would actually get through. He had asked her to send it to Buck West rather than Smoke Jensen, believing that by doing so it would get Smoke's attention more quickly. Now he wondered if perhaps he'd been too smart by half. What if the telegram didn't reach Smoke? For that matter, what if the telegram did reach Smoke, but because it was addressed to Buck West, he chose to do nothing about it?